This is part two of our discussion on wargaming with Mr. Sebastian Bay. If you haven't already, I'll encourage you to check out the previous episode, as this episode picks up in the middle of a discussion on wargaming.
Why is that important? It's not that you rolled a one or you don't have magic hands, right? It's the fact that you as a commander, if you're at a battalion or brigade level, right? You're like, hey, that platoon that you sent up the hill, that was manned by, you know what I mean, Lieutenant Smuckatelli and his even dumber, like, Sapsarn, right? And they just went diddle-diddle up the middle and got, mowed down, right?
Greetings, and welcome to the Operational Arch, the official podcast of the School of Advanced Military Studies, dedicated to bridging the gap between tactics and strategy through the study of operational art and the operational level of war. I'm Major Dan Warner, here alongside Majors Kelsey Kurtz and Josh Bedingfield. We'll be your hosts today. Our guest today is Sebastian Bay, an adjunct assistant professor at Georgetown University's Center for Strategic Studies, where he teaches a graduate course, Basics of Wargaming, where students learn and research game design and educational wargames. Welcome, Sebastian, to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me. I'll speak for myself, right? Like, I love reading books, right? But reading books are passive learning, right? It doesn't stick with you, right? When you're in we always make fun of the DoD and our leadership in general by saying, oh, you guys are fighting the last war, right? It's not because they're dumb, right? It's because it is the last, recent, most powerful, vivid chapter in their memory as an officer or as a leader that they refer to, right? The analogy I always use is like your brain is like the book is like a book, right? And there are well-worn pages, right? And pages that you sort of can dig to if you like think really hard about it, right? But in the moment when we make decisions, we always go to the well-worn page, right? And those are often vivid because they're emotional and because they are they're powerful because they're experiential, right? I'll ask Dan this, right? It's like, Dan, like how many times as a leader or as a person were you given advice, right? Not to date somebody or don't buy that car, and you still did it, and only after experiencing it did you like, you know what? That's right, right? I have lots of them. I can share many, but I'm sure all of you guys have those experiences.
Yeah, or the that's exactly it. Or the converse of it, of you know, right? You take someone's experience and you hone in on that instead of sensing the environment around you. So I have not listened to advice, and I have listened to advice to a singular person, right? Despite what I knew or other people were telling me, and it's like leaned on that experience because of my relationship with that person or the shared experience between us.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, what about you, Kelsey?
Kelsey's never made a bad decision in her entire life.
Sorry, I couldn't mute the mic. No, when you were talking about the well-worn page and also the example of decision-making as practicing an instrument, I immediately went to Starship Troopers, thinking about the advice of the NCO, you know, playing the violin and then turning it over to the lieutenant in combat and how that can, you know, maybe set up an inappropriate decision-making divide where you let the relationships with NCOs or, you know, adjacent units kind of cloud the decision-making process at your level.
Yeah, great reference. And yeah, like, it's really about what affects our decision-making, and we only get good at things by practicing, right? Practice makes perfect, right? It's a maxim for a reason, and we don't do enough practice. And Josh?
Yeah, no, I'm just kind of thinking about this concept of, you know, I'm struggling very much so right now about just not just saying yes to everything that you are saying, because if anybody has not caught on yet, like Dan and I are probably two of Sam's most token war gamers. It is hard for me not to see value in wargaming and play a board game that has nothing to do with the military like Root and say, oh my gosh, how many things can I train with this board game for a military practitioner through a game of forced domination? What I'm curious about, rather than just saying everything that I just said and then saying yes at the end of it, is pretend for a moment like I'm a lieutenant and I've never encountered wargaming before, and I'm listening to the podcast and I'm like, goodness, I really want to find out a way to tap into what you're talking about right now. But I see in front of me all of these barriers. Nobody in the unit plays war games. I don't know what war game to start with. I don't know how to talk to other people about how to integrate it into a training regime, much less maybe convince the unit to block out time on the training calendar to play Root for training purposes. What would you say to her?
So first things first, I would say read the article that Major Paul Kearney and I did for the Army War College about, you know, in tactical wargaming at the edge, right, at the echelon, at the tactical echelons. I'm writing another follow-on piece for somebody soon. Hopefully they'll talk us talk about some of that, and I will give a little preview of some of that argument. Is one, yes, there are so many challenges at the tactical echelon, at the company, brigade, like whatever level you're at. Training schedules, you know what I mean? Admin stuff, you know what I mean? PCS, like it is. I see so many times as a war game designer, people that email me and be like, Sebastian, I listened to you on this podcast or this read this article, love some advice, and I work with them while they're at that unit. They struggle, they kick and crawl, and they're able to set something up. They PCS, and it just disappears. Just poof, gone, right? And I've literally had personal experiences where the same unit has asked me for the same question just over PCS cycles, right? It is hilarious and sort of sad and tragic on my end, and it is a hard thing, right? So one thing I would say is we need to find ways if we want tactical wargaming down at the echelons that we want it at, right, at the grassroots level, to find ways where we can teach people how to use war games. Not to be war game designers, right? Not everyone needs to be a designer, right? But to be like, hey, or, you know what I mean? I was talking to a colleague of mine, I was like, and this is my own enlisted bias, I was like, hey, we should have leverage enlisted education, right? And have those times of like, hey, instead of teaching you drill at career school at the College of Enlisted Military Education or advanced school, blah, 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 right? Like, we're going to teach you how to train your subordinates in different ways, using games, using other things, because your job is to, you know what I mean, nurture and foster enlisted talent, right? So if that's your mission on a day-to-day garrison base, right? Like, let's teach you how to use certain games, right? Like, teach you how to use land power, teach you how to do these things at the enlisted level, so you have that talent resident and lots of people. Because one of the problems right now is that it is so reliant on the officer class of leadership, and there's so few of them, and they have lots on their plate already, and they PCS just more often, right? So the idea is like, hey, push it down to where you have 5 or 6, 7 or 8 staff sergeants in a unit, right? Or gunnies or whatever that can keep that institutional knowledge in a unit and have them prepare them to use them. Be like, hey, let's teach you how to use Root in a PME sense, right? What books can you pair it with? What, you know what I mean, seminars, what lectures, what podcasts, right? Because what I argue is not that educational wargaming is a panacea to all things, right? Is I'm saying that, hey, I see the mixture of learning techniques that we use in PME, and the mixture is wrong, right? And saying, hey, we need more experiential, but the perfect ideal way I think about wargaming at the educational for education at the unit level is thinking, hey, read this book, right? Josh, Dan, Kelsey, you and I, we're all going to read a book, right? We're going to read, I don't know, Ghost Fleet, or, you know, I mean, a historical book, Killing Angels, or whatever.
No. We're gonna read Hisserson and Deep Operations before we play the Eerie in Root, and devise a winning strategy by penetrating into the depth and width of the cats.
So,
and crushing the empire before they're able to
exactly fight. Right. So those are that, right. So you can do a lot of different things, right. And the idea is to pair those things, right? Like, read books, listen to podcasts, right? Have group discussions, play games, right? This is why I love the Warfighting Society movement that's happening in the Marine Corps and other services, because that is really embracing that myth, that approach of like mixed learning, mixed methods, and across ranks, right? To share that knowledge, right? Because I can preach to you via PowerPoint till my eyes bleed and my throat is gone, right? But it does not guarantee that you learn, right? Because all learning methods have their biases, right? So you guys have gone to SAMS and CGSC, right? Like, group seminars are great. They're really free and open, right? But also personalities play into it, right? Gender plays into it, right? Rank plays into it, right? So It's not to say seminars are bad. It's just that they have weaknesses in some regards, right? So, okay, so that's okay. But what if we use another method that makes up for those things, right? Where you have a game that doesn't involve having to talk if you're a shy person, right? Same thing for game designs. Matrix games are inherently biased to people who have strong personalities, right? And also have rank deferment problems, right? So the idea is, like, how do I build this whole approach, just like operational art, right? How do I build that approach with mixed techniques and mixed risks, right, to get to the educational objective that I want?
Yep. Sir, so personally, I loved the game Root. I know Josh seems to be an unhealthy skeptic there, because I loved that it was a commercial game off the shelf that I could take home and absolutely wipe the board with my spouse with, you know, at the end of the night and call it a date night. It was good. But I've also anchored on to what you said about teaching subordinates or peers and inherent biases that are within our decision-making process. And how can you talk a little bit about how you see war game designers or you yourself are integrating morality and diverse perspectives into your war game design to help kind of overcome those biases or approach decisions that are moral based?
Yeah. So you have obviously been stalking on my Twitter, but it is, so as a pet project, so for me, I'm focused on not only educational wargaming, but also fostering wargame designers that, you know, can take the torch, right? And one of those things I do is to design pet projects with them for sponsors, either in the units or in the war colleges or anywhere else like SAMS. And usually ask an educator or a commander, like, what do you want? What do you want to teach to your units? And we'll build a game to it, right? As long as you're willing to give us a long lead time, because we're not getting paid to do it, right? So right now we're designing, Betsy Joslin, who's at IDA, and I are designing a game on ethics called Horns of a Dilemma, right? It is based on, currently the game design is really based on the notion that you serve as the commander of some kind of naval or ARGMU formation, and there are three major metrics: the morale of a unit, the integrity of a unit, and the readiness of a unit, right? And the fourth metric is what we call the fit rep. It is your own rating, as the institution has said you are good or a bad officer, right? And the whole point of the game is really sort of stringing together a bunch of ethical, like, decision games, right, to be more game-like, right? So each stage, right, or phase, what we call it, you're posed with three, like, dilemma cards, right? Like, a sexual assault case, a DUI case, you know what I mean? Negligent discharge, whatever, right? And at various stages of this sort of like D&D campaign, right? Like pre-deployment, deployment, right? Workup, all that stuff, right? And at different points. And the whole purpose of the game is card-driven, where you have sort of responses of like, this is the closest thing I would do to this dilemma, right? Each of the choices are unknown what their effect are, just like you don't know what it will be in real life. And an adjudicator sort of like has a reference sheet, what we call the consequence matrix, and they move your metrics up and down, right? And whatever is your lowest metric in terms of morale, integrity, or readiness will either increase or decrease your fit rep, right, for that turn, right? And then at the end, all these add up to a score and so forth. But the most important part of this sort of game is the discussion, right? So all of us at a table, we'll all have our own unit sheets, we have their own metrics, that we all start off at the same portion. And we all get the same dilemma card and we all respond to it, right? And then the key portion is like, hey, Josh, why did you choose A and I chose B? Right, and Dan also chose A, but he chose it for a different reason than me, right? Because that's really is like, why did you make it? What were the factors that you deliberated on it, right? And so forth, and it's sort of unwrapping that moral texture, right? And sort of that, you know, ethical dimensions of decision making as a commander. Whether it's like, hey, I have two. One of the case moral ethical dilemmas that the War College provided us that we're trying to incorporate is like, you have two NCOs, right? They both have done the same sort of problem where they, you know what I mean, had the same issue, right? One is a single mom, right? One is a single bachelor, right? And by the rule of the book, you're supposed to demote them and take pay, right? And one of the choices is like, yes, absolutely. Just follow the book, demote both of them, be agnostic to consequence, right? And just be on your way, right? I follow the book, right? Or do you consider it like, hey, like one of these NCOs is a single mom and that will adversely affect that family way more than my single Marine or whatever, right? Or sailor, right? Do I consider that and alter my decision? Is that ethical, right? There's no right answer. The game is not really designed to produce your right answer, but it's to get all those commanders in the same room that one day we'll have to make these kind of decisions and ask yourself, like, why did Kelsey make that decision? Why did Dan make that decision? Or why did Josh and Sebastian make their decisions, right? And that's how the game is supposed to be designed. But the reason I really wanted to design this game is, one, as war game designers and educational gaming, we tend to focus on the tactical, right? And the operational, the whiz bang, cool technology things, right? And that's okay. Those are all important. But that's also not always the full spectrum of what you do as a commander, right? And I wanted to dig at that and be like, hey, these are hard choices that you make as a boss, as a manager, as a leader, and let's prepare you, right? Because let's not just only prepare you of what door to kick in or what missile to launch, right? But also be like, how do I take care of my sailors in an ethical and a moral and responsible manner, right? And one of the things that you probably saw on Twitter is like, I was asking people like, hey, what are dilemmas you face, right? And I got some interesting responses that even made me think of like, what would I do?
Sir, so in some of your RAND reports, when you did wargaming for them, the sections on the debates that took place during the game were some of the most interesting portions to read. Do you think that has more value as lessons learned to encourage, you know, looped in learning during the decision-making process?
So you mean just the discussion that happens in games?
Yes.
So I actually think that's where the most value is, right? It's not so much the decision that I go left with my tank versus go right with my tank, right? It is like, what was the discussion? What were the trade, like, let's say you and I are a team, right? And what we're discussing our course of action of this move in a tactical war game. We're like, what's not important is like what happens, because it could go either way, right? But it's really a question of like, what did Kelsey and Sebastian emphasize? And like, this is important. This is a window of opportunity. Why did we perceive it this way? Those are really the interesting parts where you do a lot of the learning. This is why James Therrod and I, he and I believe that when you war game, you should always have people in pairs, right? Because that pair is able to help each other get comfortable with the game, but also have that dialogue, right? Explicitly and out loud, right? So if you and I are paired up to do this game, whether it be Roots, right? And we're trying to beat your husband again, right? It doesn't sound like he'll offer much resistance, right? Or it's some other game, right? We're like, the question is not so much exactly happened on the map. That's sort of important, as there's a feedback loop, but it's really like, Kelsey, I don't think we should do this because I think we should prioritize, blah, 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 right? And you're like, no, that's stupid, right? We should do this, right? I'm like, well, convince me, right? And so forth. That is the really important portion, right? Because you're understanding why and how you're seeing it and how I'm seeing it and what we end up compromising on, right?
That's a very good point that I don't want to say I didn't know it before, because I've worked under Dr. Sterrett, but this idea of you're probably never going to be a decision maker in a vacuum, not having to pitch your idea to somebody. So if you do a war game, if you do an exercise in pairs, that ability to express your ideas and create buy-in is almost more important than the actual learning of a quote-unquote good decision. Because, a few times you're going to be Napoleon and you can say, hey, we're going to go here. So that didn't hit me till now. So I'm a little, that's good. I like that a lot, actually.
Yeah, it's all about the small things I found when it comes to making a fertile ground for you guys to learn as players from educational games. And it's the small things, like, do you do it in pairs? How do you do a hot wash, right? One of the things I learned facilitating games for PME and in units is like, call on people and prepare them, be like, hey, These are the questions we're going to do, or we're going to talk about at the hot wash at the very beginning of the game, right? And be like, hey, think about these decisions, right? Write them down, right? Think about them in the game and during white space. And then at the end, I'm going to call on you and be like, Kelsey, I want you to hear this. Dan, I want to hear your opinion, right? And be prepared with that. And I think that also helps learning, because it brings you back that we're not just playing a game to play the game and have a fun time. That's all good and important, but it's all about the learning, right? These are the learning objectives. These are the learning questions that we want to drive towards too. And you as a facilitator, as a game designer, should always keep that in mind.
Not to stray off too far into war game design, but when you mentioned this war game that you guys are developing, this game you're developing, and it was card driven. So, you know, we're like all in the books right now, rereading the stuff that we've read this year. And there's this great article. I'm going to destroy this guy's name, Alan Baerchin. And he talks about Clausewitz and nonlinearity, right? And in there, hidden there, is this gem about card games and poker potentially being what Clausewitz is talking about when he's talking about chance. Unpredictability is one thing, and then chance is this other thing. And it's this like psychological aspect of playing a card game, right? It's not directive, right? You're not guaranteed the result when you roll the dice, right? Chance-wise, there's a psychological aspect of, you know, out-muscling mentally your opponent when you play a card game versus when you're playing a dice game. So when you mentioned that, it made me think about how we could potentially improve, you know, not to go back into tactical games, but improve some of these things by giving like an anti-system or some type of card mechanic where you might know you don't have the best option, but you don't know that your opponent also doesn't have a bad hand, if that makes sense.
So I will dissect that a little bit further. So in design terms, what Clausewitz is probably referring to between cards and dice, right, is what we call input and output randomness, right? So all games have different types of randomness, but the two main genres of randomness in games is input and output, right? Input randomness is like poker or Texan Hold'em, right? Where you make a decision, right, after a random act, right? So like I deal you cards randomly and you make the decision after that random act, right? So it is inputting to your decision cycle, right? So you see the cards, you see the flop before I make a bet and I can hold, I can collapse, right? So there's this notion of there is this uncertainty of what card will come up, right? But I can adjust my decision upon the act of randomness, right? Output randomness is what we often associate with dice, right? I make a decision and that act is adjudicated or judged or determined to be successful on a probability stochastic way, right? Where I need a 7 and below, I roll a dice, I get an 8, I have failed, right? The decision has already happened, I'm committed to it, and now the dice is essentially trying to say, of your probability, this is where you have sat, right? Lots of people hate output randomness, right? Because they feel that dice rolling can be, and it's purely psychological, right? It's probabilistic, stochastic, all that stuff, but people don't like it. They just don't like it, right? So that's why like Euro games that have a lot of card-driven mechanics are really popular, right? James Sterrett and Mike Dunn and I love the game Frederick and Maria because it has a card-driven input randomness element to how combat is adjudicated, right? You know exactly what cards you have, exactly what terrain you're good on, right? And you don't, and there's a level of uncertainty of what you know what your opponent has, like what Joss has in his hand, right? But you are much more comfortable, right, losing in that game because you already sort of know the realm of the possible, right? Versus rolling dice, right? Whether that be en route or access and allies and so forth, right? So I think that is also a consideration as designers, like what kind of randomness do we want our players to have? And whether that's output randomness like dice or cards, and also what we call in game design, what we call information horizons, right? How much information and how often do we give our players new information and refresh that knowledge, right? So like in Littoral Commander, the information horizon is very sporadic, right? Where I know where a unit is and it can cover and hide the very next impulse and that information is gone, right? Right? Or it can be in a stack and they can shuffle it and so forth, right? So like I may even know that unit is a Heimar section, but I can't find, like I can't in the game, I need to find it again to target it, right? So, and different games can do this in different ways, right? Like StarCraft does this for Information Horizons. Any kind of like MMORPG does this, right? And it's really how much information do we give to our players, like how often and how much, to inform their decision cycle and their level of uncertainty.
Sorry, the hamster is going really, really rapidly in my brain right now as I'm looking at my wall of war games. Josh is probably going to have to clean this up as we struggle to come with words. I just don't want to continue in this wormhole because I know we're close to the end of the episode, but I think there's like there's maybe some value for like the non-war gamers to like understand those concepts, but I don't know like how deep you want to go into it, right? Like just you describing the randomness factor, input or output randomness, like that can articulate the abstractions of a war game that would make the skeptic go, oh, okay, right?
Yeah, I dissent to this after rolling like some critical sixes against Josh in the Korea war game that we played. I would like to think that it was not luck or chance, but pure magic hand skill.
Yeah, but so, and okay, so this is another common thing that I want to talk about, right? Most people are like, also have bad experiences with games where if they lose on a bad dice roll, and that's often why they hate output randomness, right? But I always, and as a facilitator, I've learned to be like, all right, Kelsey, you got straight sixes when you needed all sixes. Great, awesome, well done, right? But, right, and Dan got, like, straight ones, and he needed just a two, right? Like, oh, like, so bad, right? Like, stochastically, that is, like, 1%, 1%, 1% chance that you got that, right? But why is that important? It's not that you rolled a one or you don't have magic hands, right? It's the fact that you as a commander, if you're at a battalion, a brigade level, right, you're like, hey, that platoon that you sent up the hill, that was manned by, you know what I mean, Lieutenant Smuckatelli and his even dumber, like, Saf Sarn, right? And they just went diddle-diddle up the middle and got, mowed down, right? And you as a battalion commander, after you have issued that order, that is, like, a roll of the dice, man. And this is what I say as even as a squad leader, when I only had 12 Marines underneath of me, I was like, my first fire team, I know they're going to do what I tell them, right? Like, they are good, right? Second one, right? Like, you can go either way, honestly, right? Depends on what they did that weekend, right? The last one, that is a straight, like, crapshoot, right? Like, I do not know if they will end up on the hill that I, like, told them on, or three mountain ranges, like, to the right of it, right? And I always say, I'm like, hey, man, not all dice are created equal, and sometimes you get the crappy ones, sometimes you get the good ones, and it's really about, like, hey, what happens when you're one of your lieutenants or one of your brigades, right? Like, look at military history, right? Look at Gettysburg, right? Like, not all commanders do what you tell them to do, right? Or in the manner, or in the speed, or at the timeliness, or the character in which you want them to do it, right? And dice are just a great way to represent that kind of dynamic, right? It's not to say output randomness is bad, but if you want, like, hey, I want them to feel the fact that, like, not all commanders will obey orders or perform well, then yeah, like, dice is great, right? That's why, like, leadership ratings in Civil War battles are so great, because there's so much, like, history and knowledge and scholarship about literally brigade commanders would be like, Dan, as this brigade commander was so good, and this one was crap, right? But that's a great way, right? But if you're looking at, like, hey, I want them to understand risk assessment, I want them to understand how to deal with the possibility and trade-offs, then maybe input randomness is the best, right? Be like, hey, I've dealt you this hand. How do you make lemonade out of this hand, right? And maybe that's a great one for operations, right, and so forth, right? But you're hitting on different elements, and it's not to say one is better. Just people like to have input randomness, but what players like is not always what you should give them, right? Sometimes you have to force them to eat their veggies, right? Even if it's intellectual veggies.
Yeah, and then with the output randomness, I've found you have an opportunity to where, you know, Kelsey rolls three sixes in a row and she wins. All right, that's cool. But what decisions did you make prior to that one that put you in this situation, right? So for the loser, is there anything you could have done to have a better position of relative advantage to create it harder for the enemy to beat you? Or for Kelsey, if you're going to replicate this, what can you do prior to the roll of the dice, your actions, right, to give yourself, you know, these positions of relative advantage? Because really that's what you're, like, mentally trying to get people to think of, is continual relative advantage, regardless of what it is that advantage is or the task, right? It doesn't always have to be COFAMs or power, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think those, when I facilitate games for PME, I think those are the moments I write down in my notes and be like, hey, Kelsey like crushed it on this one heroic stand, right? And she like, she had a 5% chance of hitting the ship and she got it, right? And there are a couple times I've seen that in like LOTOL Commander and other educational games I run. And the question is like, hey, you won, you got lucky, great job, right? But let's like dissect that, right? What if we're like, even in our own games here at CNA, sometimes we will look at what we call key decision points, right? Or inflection points. And we'll say, hey, we're just going to models and sim that one decision, that one missile engagement, that one whatever, right? And see where on the curve Kelsey's like, you know, outcome fell, right? And you're like, hey, that's in the 5% positive end, right? Like, hey, that's a very low chance that you get that. And often the standard deviation would be this. Then in terms of analysis and discussion, you can be like, hey, we got lucky and we had heroes on those hills, right? But if we had average Joes on that hill most of the time, as we probably would, what would most likely outcome be? And how would Kelsey adapt to it? Because that's the key thing, right? Is that it's not to always rely on heroes or dunces or the other way around. It's just like, hey, I got heroes and I can do this now. But now, but also let's go back and like, what if I didn't have heroes on those hill that, you know what I mean, the next Smedley Butler or whatever, right, on that hill to defend it with the machine gun and the cigar in his mouth, right? So forth.
Yeah, how do you win with Pemberton and not Napoleon as your general, right?
Exactly, right?
Yeah, I mean, I will say that I really appreciate you using, you know, the Marines' predilection towards frontal assault at all costs. As the form of maneuver for these fake squads that you've been talking about. But you did forget the fourth category, which are your patents, which make a new game
yeah.
and play a different game than you told them to play and still win. This has been a really fascinating conversation. I'm super hyped to go play another round of Littoral Commander. But on that note, as we kind of close out, do you have any, you know, kind of closing words or final thoughts for the audience?
So closing... remarks, I guess, is go buy Littoral Commander, my game. It's called Littoral Commander Indo-Pacific. It is a PME game that I designed for the Marine Corps as a pet project because I wanted to create a game where young NCOs and senior NCOs could play with their officers, their captains and their majors, and really look at not only the Sanded Force and EABO, but also like MDO and all domain operations and think about, hey, how does cyber affect my formations at the company level and so forth, right? How do I do ground-based fires against ships, right? This is important with the MDTF, with the Marine Littoral Regiment and so forth, and I really wanted to design that game as a sandbox, so go buy it, go support it, go run it, and so forth. And I would say is for all those who are listening, you're like, hey, I would love to do more of this gaming stuff in my command, in my unit, wherever you are, right? Whether it's in the schoolhouse and so forth, please feel free to reach out to me on Twitter, Sebastian Bay, or just find me on at Georgetown's email and so forth and reach out to me. I'm more than happy to help you as much as I can, as much as my time allows and my sleep cycle allows, because I think it is incredibly important and the most impact that will happen from games will not be in the schoolhouses, just like at Sam's, right? I think that is the first step, right? The real impact of it is really the question of when Kelsey, Josh, and Dan go back to their units, wherever that may be, whether that's a PAO unit, whether that's an infantry company or whatever, if they are able to use wargaming forward, that's where the real juice is made, right? And that's where I want it to happen.
The views and expressions heard here are those of the authors and do not reflect the official position or opinion of SAMS, the U.S. Army, or the U.S. government. Stay up to date on all things SAMS by following us on Twitter at US_SAMS and on Instagram at US.SAMS. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe or to follow the podcast. Additionally, if you have recommendations for an episode or otherwise would like to engage with the team, feel free to email us at operationalarch@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.